brought my reading.
You want to borrow mine? John.
Call this meeting to order. This is the Wednesday, May 25th, 2016, meeting of the Johnson County Board of Supervisors. This is a work session. We are getting started here at 1:30. Our plan is to go until about 4 o'clock, so hopefully we have the right amount of agenda items here for that. First thing on our agenda today is the spring amendment to the fiscal year 2016 Johnson County budget. We have had some fairly extensive discussion on this, and we have a couple folks from finance here. If we have any further questions, this is on our formal agenda tomorrow.
And you had your public hearing last week, and so our pattern has been to put it on the next work session in case there wasn't any discussion at the meeting necessarily about any additional changes, but it's just on. If there are no other additional changes, then it'll be presented tomorrow as it was at the public hearing.
Anything else any board members want
to? I'm sorry, I'm having network trouble, but. So the dollar amount we're considering is not the dollar amount that was advertised.
That is correct.
And so the resolution that we will be considering tomorrow morning and next week informal has been changed to and I just can't get to it because I'm having server trouble. It has been changed to reflect the consensus of the board of what that dollar amount should be, right?
That is correct.
Okay.
Yes, actually a lesser amount than was originally published.
Okay. What are those, what's the new number?
Bottom line. The bottom line is a change of $1,043,397.
All right, so now I have another question, and I know we don't have the answers to this, so after we decided this amount that we would amend the budget for roads projects, and the dollar amount that we decided on was money that was spent in FY15 that was actually budgeted in FY16, which made FY16 short. Okay, so that's basically, we rounded up, but that's basically the amount of money we agreed to amend the budget. After we did that, they went out and broke a bridge. Not just teasing. So is there anything about this that we need cash before June 30th about the 965 bridge? I mean, we have to go out to engineering. I mean,
Dan Grady, finance. I can address your question. I talked to Lori at the beginning of the week to ask her if there'd be any expenses that came in before the end of the year. She said there would not. So as far as adding anything for the bridge at this time, we probably don't need to. It'll be a next fiscal year.
But we did go out and rent all the
lights
to change the traffic. I mean, so this is May, whatever this is that we got it, let's say 20. And so that's like 6 or 7 weeks of that rental that's in this fiscal year. Is there able to absorb that in something else?
We didn't discuss the lights per se. I will assume that it can be at this point, without knowing exactly, but we discussed project expenses as far as fixing the bridge, and there wouldn't be anything done before June 30th, so.
Okay, so just one final, what I'd ask is one final check with Greg or Rob about the engineers we'll need to hire and the lights, and whether or not we have a need to amend the right to do that into this year's budget.
I believe that the engineer is already budgeted, per my conversation again with Lori, because that was something we talked about. They have, I believe, $120,000 budgeted for engineering expense specifically for that bridge.
But not until FY18, so.
FY17, but yes, I believe that's correct.
Okay, so I'll just say that before we talk about this tomorrow morning, if there was anything that needed to be changed, I'm willing to do that to I mean, because the budget amendment just had a dollar amount. It wasn't project specific. So if we need to put more money in FY16 because of the 965 bridge, I'm willing to talk about that.
Well, the most we could take it up is back to the original dollar amount.
Absolutely. But the original dollar amount was $700,000 more or some number. So we're never going to get to that number. I mean, they're not building it.
We shouldn't. Just if that number was higher than that, we'd have to start the amendment process all over again. We don't want to do that. So
if there is a need, then I want to be told that by tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, and then we could change the dollar amount of the resolution, probably before 9 o'clock.
I'll go make a phone call now, and I'll know.
Yep. That's great. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks.
Anything else from any board members? All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Next on our agenda is Social Services Emergency Funding Grants. Lynette.
Good afternoon. Last week at the work session, we had a discussion regarding making funds available that were from current year budgets that were underspent. And it was determined that a total of $100,000 would be made available for block grant funding for emergency assistance and capacity building. And that a maximum of $50,000 would be allocated for youth development programming, or at least $50,000 would be made available for youth development and juvenile delinquency prevention programming. I prepared an RFP that's ready for release today, but I wanted to provide you another opportunity to offer any feedback that you might have prior to the release of that RFP. I guess this will be released tomorrow, the 25th, right? Yes, tomorrow.
Any questions or concerns for Alina?
I apologize, I'm not able to get on the network, so I can't read it. I looked at it when I first saw this, but
I looked at it right away, and I'm looking over it again, and I see nothing.
It's fine with me.
It concerns me.
So can you just talk about the dates? Lisa just scrolled over it.
Yes, the funding application will be released on May 26th. We can actually make that funding release today. I can switch that out so I can get that sent out today if that works better. Application deadline will be June 10th, with anticipated contract terms being July 1st through December 31st.
So in according to this packet that Lisa's been able to bring up, both those dates are not correct in here. So
May 20th and June 6th.
Which was your original plan?
Oh, so this was modified when it was requested that it be added to the agenda. So you must not have the most
So recent. Applications would be due June 10th then?
Applications would be due June 10th. And okay. I will forward you the amended proposal, RFP. Yeah, so grant timeline, release of the RFP, May 26th. Application deadline will be June 10th with a program start date, contract start date of July 1st. And the contract term then would run through December 31st, which would put us right in line then with the likely release, or I guess the beginning of the flex funding contracts for FY17. Typically begin January 1st.
Do you anticipate fewer applicants because of the speeded up timeline?
I think it's difficult to project how many applicants we'll receive. We have, in my experience, it's great to have an RFP out for 3 to 4 weeks, if at all possible. But for individuals that are planning to apply for an application, submit an application, they're typically waiting until the end of the application period to submit that. I think because this is for emergency funding and capacity building rather than new and innovative programs, we're not asking people to put together a lengthy proposal to describe a new program. It's a pretty compact application. It's It's not lengthy. They're describing services they're already providing. So I think the shortened application period will be fine for the purpose of this.
So they've already gotten something written from the initial
funding
that they got?
Yes.
So they're just asking for it. They have to provide information about how they've grown and how they need this to continue.
The need, yeah, description of need, what, and then cost, and what are the outcomes going to be. It's pretty, I think we have four questions. It's a pretty pretty simple application. So there's five, and then the budget.
For what it's worth, I've heard from, run into them or heard from, I think, four agency directors who just said, you know, we understand this is probably one-time funding, but we desperately need it. And so I think they were already working on applications without knowing the exact questions we were going to ask. I think the word spread quickly that, so, I mean, I would lay money that we get more requests than we have funding.
I would anticipate the same thing.
Any other comments or questions for Lynette?
No, I'm
really good.
Looks like we're ready to roll.
And we have released the hunger relief RFP as well, went out last week. That's a slightly different timeline. That's on May 20th. That one was released May 20th with the June 8th deadline. So both those applications will be due the same time or the same week. And I will be forwarding those to you for your review.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, next thing on our agenda is power purchase agreements for solar voltaic systems for admin building and health and human services building, roof and open space. We've got Becky and Josh here with us from PDS. Good afternoon.
Hello, how are you?
Great.
We're teetering right on the brink of West Coast. So, we need to, at least it's air conditioned here.
Move your desk over here.
Seven lights. So, I just wanted to come before the board and discuss our status of the RFPs that we received for a solar array on top of this building, HHS, and the admin building, a ground mount system for the admin. We were originally working with a firm called Go Solar. The board decided to go a different direction for various reasons, and now we are working with Eagle Point out of Duke, Iowa. So, just a reminder of where we are at. Here is the administration building, proposed construction site. Here, for reference, this is the Veterans Memorial. Here would be the administration building. And here is the HHS roof. Okay. It would be a ballast system. So, as we have been going forward, doing our due diligence with Eagle Point, it came to our attention that there was a discrepancy in the original proposal that they provided to us in February. So essentially, they made an error in calculating the buyout, and there was a difference of approximately $59,000. So the 10 years of the PPAs plus the buyout is now $552,000 versus $493,000. They said a difference of approximately $59,000. The buyout for admin increased by $28,000. HHS buyout increased $35,000. It was the general prerogative of the board to continue forward, as we still have two public hearings regarding the PPA that we need to go through. However, we did run into, I don't know if it was miscommunication or what has happened, but it turns out that, according to Eagle Point, that the PPA, that the draft that we received from them, that we would be required to buy the system out. So for example, with our array out at Secondary Roads in Moxie, that is an option to buy out. This is would be a requirement. So after 10 years, we'd either A, be required to buy the system out, or we would need to renegotiate and continue forward in the PPA for another 5 years, at which after 15 years, we would have the option to buy out if we wanted, or continue forward for another 5 years to 20 years, where we would be required to eventually buy out the system. Staff felt that this was a big enough change that we needed to come back before the board, because essentially I was not comfortable agreeing or creating a power purchase agreement where I would be spending a, so for the HHS building, $129,900. I didn't want to agree to that. So here is just a little bit about the payout. Even if it still does pencil out, I guess bottom line, it pencils out, we will see a net positive cash flow. So for the admin coverage, it's we use approximately 480,000 kilowatt hours annually. The ground mount system would cover approximately 25%, 111,000 kilowatt hours, and this is what over 25 years the avoided cost would be. $60,000, if you go in net present value, say at 2%, it would be $24,500 approximately. I guess here is the PPA, the buyout cost, $124,800. So after, or my correction, thanks Becky, so the buyout would actually be $85,100.
So you're on the ground-mounted one.
Right.
Open. So I'm looking at this chart, and the outright purchase price is $325,125.
Correct.
Power purchase agreement with all the escalating and the mandatory buyout costs $342,226, according to your chart. So we're not actually being compensated for any tax credits in this. What am I missing in your chart?
I'm not sure I'm understanding.
So if you go back to that spreadsheet one, though, and our pages.
Oh, this.
So if you go to the bottom line, it says it's $325,125 outright purchase.
Correct.
Total cost of power purchase agreement with, so the additional cost plus the fees and that mandatory buyout in 10 years is going to cost us $342,226. So it actually costs $17,000 more to do the power purchase agreement. So we're not being compensated for any tax credits.
Correct. So the tax credit, that this is the deal that Eagle Point is providing to us. And I think this is 342. This is in today's dollars, so it would be that net present value. But no, you're definitely right. These arrays, they are coming in much more expensive than we have in the past. And I'm not really privy to, I know we have a representative from Eagle Point. He might be able to address your question better, but you're right. It is not. I have some questions about the tax credits and how that
so
works in.
On this one, it's going to cost the people of Johnson County $17,000 more than just buying it.
Right, and the issue is we can't, if we were to just, we can't just buy it because it's over the
sure, we'd
the
have
required
to
state code, and then we could have bought the bid. And that's like, for whatever reason, you can't do that with a solar array. You can't have someone inspect the system and then put it out the bid and come to build it. It just, we looked into that in the past, and we just couldn't make it work. No one was interested in it. We could have someone design us a system, but then putting it out to bid, it just, they're like, why would I design you a system when I just want to sell you a system right now?
And sure, but we're doing the exact same thing here.
Mm-hmm.
No. I mean, we've requested proposals. We go to a public hearing to accept one of the proposals. It'd be the same thing if we just said, here's $325,125, we could just have a public hearing and buy it, right?
We would have to put it out to bid and go through that whole bid process. And the problem that we ran into, no one was interested in submitting bids.
So they're not interested in selling a solar system to the county?
I think so. This is where the system of weight is, and it's really confusing. Well,
the dollars to me just don't cash out to even mess with the power purchase agreement anymore. I mean, the reason we used to mess with it, I mean, and we've done two of them, is because they get tax credits. They needed the tax credits. They passed on some of that savings to us. And now that's not happening. And so, I mean, I know they're all busy, but if the county just wanted to buy a system, no one would sell it to us? I mean, no one would bid on a project to just buy it? They only want us to do power purchase agreements?
We asked around, and there was really nobody interested in speccing a system for us. Part of it, I think, the price of the modules is just such a fluid market right now. No one was interested, I guess, was the bottom line. I mean, we could go back and look.
Well, how is Tiffin going to put solar on their building and just buy it outright?
Power purchase agreement.
No, they're just buying it outright is what the newspaper said.
Really?
I thought that when we
if
had...
If they figured out how to do that, I would like to know, and we would definitely call them and talk. We have a very good line of communication. We actually have a meeting coming up next week with Tiffin.
If we bought it outright, we wouldn't get the reduced...
We would not realize the tax credit.
So then it...
We're not... I don't know if necessarily realizing the tax credits would be power purchase agreement. We're just sort of extending our payments and then having a balloon at the end. So it's not, it's essentially a lease, it's more of a rent to own. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But we have Larry from Eagle Point. He might be able to answer some of these questions.
Josh,
as well.
Mike, we had received, when we put out the RFP, some bids from, I can't think of the name of a firm that Jason Gideon owns.
That is.
Is that on here?
Energy Consultant Groups. And so here's his outright purchase price. So $454.
Okay,
and this is HHS for 11%.
Okay.
And, okay, this is a
little. Yeah, that's what I was having a hard time reading.
For admin, this is Becky's asking the same questions. For admin, 25% of outright purchase. $150,000.
It's
that third line in the lighter below.
Yep.
And then
EPA
would have been about
$270,000.
So they're on the same track. Okay.
So I guess put out one power purchase in the one of these proposals, and the low bidder just it didn't work out. So we go back to the second bidder, you know, and now it's been changed twice. It was changed the first time in that, the purchase price is actually higher, you know, we miscalculated, and now it's been changed that, oh, by the way, now you have to buy it out in 10 years. And from my perspective, I want solar. I want the energy savings, the greenhouse gas reductions. Saving money is secondary to that, but I don't want to pay more money than it would cost to just buy it. Now, I don't know how exactly you calculate in the maintenance, because for 10 years, they're in charge of it. I mean, and so, but to me, it seems so messed up that I don't know. There aren't enough bidders to start with, and it's pretty messed up that everybody can just keep changing their minds and say, oh, now that you're over a barrel, we want to charge you more money, and now that you don't have any other choices, we're going to add this on, and oh, by the way, you have to buy it out in 10 years, and if everything's changing, I guess there's just not enough solar companies in Iowa.
And the landscape certainly has changed. The deal that the power purchase agreement that Ward agreed to with Moxie Solar out of North Liberty is, for a kilowatt, it's much cheaper. Much better deal, but we were, Becky and I, we were both shocked when we looked at proposals. We went, wow, you know, prices have gone up, but we continue to move forward doing our due diligence, and you know, we also realized those are those intrinsic values, and you know, I hear the concerns about, you know, purchasing the outright purchase, but we don't, and the tax credits and where are they at, but I guess, you know, just bottom line is, you know, avoided cost over over 25 years, net present value is $24,000. That's just dollars and cents that failed to factor in any of the intrinsic values of greenhouse gas savings, as well as, you know, sort of achieving Johnson County's mission of setting the example and showing, you know, how, you know, everybody, you know, businesses, other local governments can do solar.
Does that include the buyout cost?
Yes. Right, Becky? Yes, it includes the buyout cost. So, and one of my concerns, if the buyout was not an option, 10 years, that's a long time. I mean, even just over the last 1 year, the solar landscape has really changed quite a bit. Who knows what it's going to be like in 10 years? Are we agreeing to pay, you know, nearly $130,000 for a solar array where it might not be worth a 10-year-old array that might not be worth $130,000, and possibly in 10 years we could put up a new one with better technology for a lesser cost? I don't know. 10 years, it's a long ways down the road. I would, just from staff's perspective, I have some concerns about, you know, the buyout is required. It wasn't required with Moxie, and to the best of my knowledge, the power purchase agreement, it was always the agreement for that, to purchase that power, not an agreement to buy the array after 10 years. It's not like you're buying it on.
And that was an additional cost after our first discussion.
Say again, Pat.
That's an additional cost, according to, or separate from the first quote.
Correct. That was an additional cost. And, you know, and to be fair, the cost was much less for the secondary roads. It was fair market value or between, or $10,000, whichever was less. So that's where we stand. If you want, I believe I put in your package. If you want, we can go over. So here's HHS, 11%. Here's our energy usage. And here it is, after 25 years, $35,000. Now, the other numbers that I showed you on this initial slide, these didn't include net present value, did they, Becky? These are just dollars. So this was essentially just $209,000 in today dollars, not dollars 10 years down the road. So.
The right thing to do is one set of issues, but if someone invests in solar and over the course of 25 years they only save $35,000, then I don't know why normal humans are putting solar on their houses or businesses or anything else. And so I think everybody needs to do some soul searching about that issue. If solar doesn't have a higher return on investment, then I think the market's basically over. Because $35,000 savings on basically you're committing $200,000 over its lifespan, that the return on investment just isn't there. Now, we should do it because we want to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions and use renewable energy. But if the solar companies can't figure out how to do this more affordably, then I would recommend that nobody uses solar, because that's just not a really good return on investment. I mean, for general public. I mean, the government doesn't need a return on investment, but businesses and homeowners do. And so they're either getting a better deal than we are, or, you know, because I can't imagine why they would lock up their money for 25 years to save, you know, $35,000.
Oakland is in most residential uses, they're starting out paying more for each kilowatt of energy. So where we're paying about 7 cents, they may be paying 9 or 10. And if they're...
So we're already getting a discount from MidAmerica,
right?
Because we're a big
so
user.
In a way, being who we are is, in a sense, a disadvantage here. We've been getting savings all along. But I think your point is well taken, that we need it. And this is just one scenario. It's hard to... We were, in a sense, conservative in estimating this. If the Mid-American rates go up faster and higher, then you would realize more savings, obviously, because you're not, you know, for every kilowatt you're buying of solar, you're saving that much more. But yeah, it's hard to predict.
Is the mandatory buyout with this company only or with all of them now?
It's just with Eagle Point. It's never to any of the other agreements that I've worked with, it has never been mandatory. And my experience with power purchase agreements, I've never heard of it mandatory. We started this process, I was under the understanding that the buyout was not mandatory, it was truly optional. Pat, did you have it?
Well, I was going to say, I'd like to have a little more information on buying it outright rather than just contracting with them. Payback would probably be a lot greater in the end if there's companies that actually provide that service.
The only issue is that also the 10 years, I mean, you have to put a value on maintenance.
Yeah.
If anything goes wrong in 10 years or whatever the terms of the power purchase agreement, it's, you know, it's going to be on the.
Well, in 10 years, I don't think you're going to see much less of service relationships first put on.
I mean, the problem with the mandatory buyout is on our last two solar projects, I mean, we discussed, if solar changes as much in the next 10 years as it did in the last 10 years, then these things are going to be worthless. And if we've met the peak of technology right now, and they lose efficiency every year they're in operation, just period. To me, the mandatory buyout, while the future Board of Supervisors may choose to do it voluntarily, because they're still getting energy even though the system is X percentage less efficient, right? And we talked about that on the other two projects, but the fact that you don't have a choice, you have to buy this, you have to write us this check, and it's mandatory. No matter how crappy those panels are compared to the new technology in 10 years, it's just interesting to me. I'm not there yet. It bothered me that Eagle Point changed their numbers that they gave us, but, you know, it wasn't within 30 days, and I kind of got that. But then they further change it to a mandatory buyout. I'm like, it seems like we're being held hostage in this deal, and we're pretty good customers, and we're pretty good people to advertise stuff. And so I'm just not there yet on this mandatory buyout, and it doesn't seem like as good a deal to me, and there's just way too many things going on, and somebody's going to have to convince me that mandatory buyout is worth the risk to the taxpayers a decade from now.
Josh and Becky, you've been involved with us a little while. What would you advise us to do?
I am not comfortable with the mandatory buyout. A lot can happen in 10 years. Technology changes. You know, what if Mid-American does something where they have a commercial scale, so I don't know what they're doing. I'm not privy to their board.
Right.
In 10 years, you are essentially, you're making a decision for a future board, I guess, and a board that's 10 years down the road.
Right. But we're also making it decision for 25 years because we've agreed to mandatory buy it in these panels last 25 years.
Right, and if you buy it at this price, it's almost, you know, you're not going to buy it and take it off. I think it's, you know, one of the great things about the power purchase agreement is that we're not required to. Then if 10 years, maybe we will. You know, maybe, like, hey, it's a great deal, let's do this, but if we don't have that option, then that gives me a little bit of pause, to be honest.
Could you re-release an RFP and make that part of it, that we want the buyout to be voluntary and not mandatory?
We can do anything the board wants.
Right, but do you think we would, by re-releasing it, and, you know, this didn't work very well. We locked in on one company, then we got off of them, because they maybe were not a qualified bidder, possibly.
Sometimes in some conversations and a little bit of research that I've been doing, you know, I'm not so certain that we even need to do an RFP. I would need to talk with Andy Chappell about that.
Yeah.
not so certain we need to do an RFP.
A lot of that's our choice.
Right, and for this project, from the beginning, I think an RFP was a good way to go because we wanted to see what was out there. You know, let's encourage a little competition and see what comes back. And what we've got back.
So theoretically, if we don't have to do an RFP, we might be able to contact our current solar provider and say, are you interested in working with this or even going back to somebody else?
You know, hey,
we want our business.
These are real initial conversations that I had with Andy and some research that I had done.
Yeah.
So I'm not an attorney.
Well, I'd like that option.
Could we just say, make a phone call, can you do this deal, yes or no? And if yes, great. If no, we can
shop it around.
But this is the board's call. We could, I guess we can either continue forward, reissue, or I can talk with Andy about other options.
One, there appears to not be enough competition in this industry, and the good news is they're all busy. But two, every city, county, I mean, you've talked at ISAC, school districts. I mean, we've been the ones preaching, go solar, go solar, go solar. And it feels like to me that maybe the industry doesn't want to do business with governmental bodies. And because these are not good prices, the rules are changing. And oh, by the way, we want this. And oh, by the way, we want that. And I mean, you guys have been at ISAC. We've been at Joint Cities. I mean, multiple supervisors and school board members across the state have talked to me about this. But it doesn't seem like the industry is prepared to do business with the government. And I don't know. This is bothering me. I'm not there, but I wanted solar out there 6 months ago, and so I mean, I wanted the carports. That's how this started. I mean, could someone build those carports and put solar on top of it? And nobody seemed to want to be able to do that project. So I don't know. I'm looking for a different solution. I'm not here on this one.
Not here on this either. I think we should just put it on hold till you talk to Andy, and if we're allowed to maybe just kind of shop around, if we don't have to issue an RFP, let's see if we can find somebody that will negotiate a deal with us. That's kind of where I'm at. So do you want our business or don't you? What kind of deal can you get it? This is what we're interested in. We don't want a mandatory buyout at the end of 10 years. Is this a big enough deal, or are we worthy of your business, or do you want to do business with us?
And I'll just say, if the mandatory buyout was off the table, I'm prepared to move forward and go to a public hearing and let everybody comment and start construction as soon as we could. But the mandatory buyout to me is just a last minute thing that really. I imagine a future board would probably buy it even if the technology was bad, because at least you were getting something. But it's just like the industry in the last 10 years to now has just completely changed. What are the next 10 years going to look like? And
I guess a little, so to Eagle Point's credit, if the buyout was not required, and even if we did buy it out, per DC watt, it's still a good value. It's below any of the competitors. But again, yes, the buyout does give me pause. And the other thing that I wanted to point out with regard to the difference between Moxie Solar and Eagle Point is the warranties. So the inverters, which are, a pretty integral part of the array and something that could possibly go bad, they only have a 10-year warranty, and we're getting string inverters, which are big, huge, giant inverters that are going to cost a significant amount of money if we had to replace them, and if one went down, it's going to take a large portion of the array offline, and they only have a 10-year warranty, whereas out of secondary roads, we use microinverters, which have a 25-year warranty, and those are just
you know, we have the, you know, the micro inverter. It's one inverter per panel, so we have, whatever, like 400 little tiny micro inverters out there. One goes, you know, we could, you know, get the credit card out, buy another one, pop it in there, and be on our way. You know, it's not a large maintenance fee, moving stuff off the move. So I think that's something to be, so we're going to be required to buy this after 10 years, and we're not, we're still not going to have, and we're not going to have any warranty left on the inverters, which is a very integral part of the system. The racking, that's 10 years, that's always 10 years, and that's basically just metal. You know, it'll get destroyed in a tornado or something that's not going to rust and fall apart. But I've had an issue with 10 years, you won't have an issue.
But the, it says there the racking on HHS is 20. I don't know if that's a typo or just the difference between the racking.
There are different types of racking.
Ballast versus ground mounts.
Okay.
But, and I did get the 20 year off the materials that were provided to us, so if somehow that is an error, maybe Larry could correct it on that. But
And I know just enough to be dangerous, but I listen to what I'm told. The string inverters versus micro inverters, various people argue different things about which is better. So I'm not willing to like take a political statement on which one's better. but I totally get what you're saying. In a micro inverter, if one goes bad, you only lost a solar panel.
It's like on, the Christmas lights.
Yeah, on a string inverter, if something goes bad, you lost the whole array.
Right.
And so I get that argument, but I also listen to, you know, everybody present. So I'm not willing to weigh in on which inverter is better. I bet 5 years from now someone will have scientific evidence, but I don't know. I wish we weren't here, and I wish this project was already over.
We do have Larry here. I mean, maybe he has some information that he could share with us.
Yeah.
Sure, would you like to come up, sir, and offer your name to the auditor's office?
Sure.
We can turn on lights if we're done.
You want lights? No, I'm good.
Okay.
Larry Stephan with Eagle Point Solar. Hey, Larry. Okay. Just a couple of points that I was you know, jotting down during this, and it has to do with, Barry Shear obviously is the owner of Eagle Point Solar, and was you know, the person that, you know, put this PPA together, and is currently negotiating the contracts with Andy. Okay. And to answer your question is, you know, the terminal buyout thing, I think Barry's objective was, in that particular side of it, was the fact that there is no risk on your end. You know exactly what the number is. It's not open to interpretation 10 years from now, 15 years from now, or 20 years from now. I believe that was his intention to do that. To address the question about the viability of the modules 10 years from now, these things will degrade about, you know, less than 0.5% per year. So 10 years from now, you're looking at an array that is warranted to be producing about 95% of what it was originally stamped at. So there's definitely value there. As far as the buyout and potentially changing that, we're right in the middle of these contract negotiations. So that's I think that's an easy question for me to go back to with Barry Shear and say, you know what, let's talk about this with either Barry and Andy to see if we can address that issue, if that's the main concern. The other point that I wrote down is, you know, when Josh and Becky recontacted me about, you know, entering into this project, we were obviously, you know, willing to go forward with this. This is something that we definitely have wanted for a long time. And it was at that point, you know, that we found the error in the original numbers. And we were very upfront about that. It was a formula error on a spreadsheet that Barry has, and you know, we caught it right away and then informed. So I think that's what it was.
I'm just one person, but if I'm fine with the numbers changing. It happened. We delayed. We didn't get back to you in 30 days where it was more binding. I mean, it's fine. If you can make this mandatory buyout go away, then I personally am happy to move forward. I want to say that Eagle Point has been leading the state and took the risk on lawsuits and challenging and even creating power purchase agreements. And so it would, you know, I've enjoyed being part of Moxie Solar because they're the number one growing industry in our area. And because they're the number one growing business in our area, they don't actually need our business right now. So, but it would be cool to have Eagle Point here too. It's just that thing caused me to like stop. And if you can make it go away, then I'm ready to move forward.
Definitely willing to ask the question. There's no doubt about that.
I also want to bring up, I had another note on my slides, but it was a conversation that I had with Barry, and I feel I need to point this out. But Barry said to expect to replace the inverters, these string inverters, around year 10, 11, or 12 at a cost of approximately $30,000. And again, that's, I had this note that's, again, part of my pause of the required buyout. So if we buy out for $130,000 at the 10-year mark, are we really buying out for $160,000? And that's seriously eroding our savings right there. You know, if we go with that present value, it's almost puts us in the negative. So there's some concerns. I mean, to be honest with you, Moxie's deal was, you know, fair sure. market value or $10,000, whichever was less. And it's a much better deal. And, you know, with looking at the cash flow of it, it gives me some pause. But, you know, the numbers, Eagle Point's numbers did come in, you know, way lower than everybody else's, you know, except for the Gold Solar firm from St. Louis, and we went a different direction. So that's just, you know, where we're at. And it's a tough decision. You know, you balance, you know, the financials versus, you know, the intrinsic value. Of doing the right thing. I'm doing the right thing. That's my.
Larry, you install systems with microinverters all the time, don't you?
Typically, when we decide to go with a microinverter or a string inverter, the microinverters typically go on smaller projects.
Okay.
Because a microinverter on 400 or 500 or 600 individual solar panels is extremely cost prohibitive.
Okay.
It's a lot more expensive. Absolutely. So, you know, that's part of the logic behind that. So we use microinverters on residential arrays that might be 30 modules or below.
Okay.
Typically,
what the difference is. Yeah.
Typically, if we go 50 or above, it's a string inverter because money.
Well, looking at the difference in initially, you know, buying it up front and the 10-year buyout, you know, it seems like a good idea to do it up front, but then you've got that 10 years of losing the maintenance, and it would be helpful to know what typical cost is over the 10 years.
The maintenance contracts that we actually charge the PPA holder on an annual basis are between $1,500 and $2,000 a year. Okay, which is a relatively small amount for the size.
Back up. I didn't read in the PPA anything about a maintenance contract for $1,500 to $2,000. It's your
Eagle Point. We're responsible for that.
Okay.
It's built
that's,
in. Yeah.
It's built
yeah,
in.
It's built
okay.
in. Yes.
That's what
I'm charging.
It's in your bid document. You're not charging us beyond
yes.
this dollar amount.
That,
it's just.
That goes, that's ours.
Okay, but right. That's what we yes. would have to pay if we bought
but if
it.
But if I was
right.
going to sell you a maintenance contract.
Got it.
Okay. Something yes, like that.
The two on the other side were panicking there.
Number we did figure.
That's why we have these conversations, correct?
He was saying what we would have to pay if, yeah, gotcha. All right, so that would be
12 times 10 yeah. times 2 grand, right? Someone do
yeah,
that math.
Can I address any other questions, concerns?
All I would say it's Barry, right?
Pardon me, yes.
Tell Barry we have more projects in the pipeline, so. When you go to talk to him about this.
No problem.
Well, we still haven't figured out how to put a dollar value on the value of going green and having the solar. How do you quantify that?
Yeah, and I personally don't have to quantify it.
Right.
There was some weird quote from me that it doesn't matter if we make money, and it made me look like an idiot, but I'll just say that the county long before me became a cool county because Mike was lobbying them and others and adopted a greenhouse gas reduction strategy. And so that's our goal, whether we make money or not. And it was always assumed we'd have to spend money on that. But, you know, making something cost out is even better, you know. So, you know, it's not so much how much you make, it's that your hands are tied in 10 years that's the problem to me.
And I'll take that to Barry. That's no problem. We'll have a conversation when I leave. There's no problem with that. So.
So you'll be back in touch with Josh or Becky then? And,
absolutely.
And once,
absolutely.
Once you guys hear something concrete enough to bring it to us, then you'll...
Well, that's so the board renegotiate with Eagle Point and see what.
See where we can end up.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you have any other questions, I'm here.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming down.
We're ready to start building this, so once we get
around
this little bump.
Yeah.
We actually had it on our construction schedule the 20th of July, or June, excuse me.
Well, maybe we can still get
very quickly.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Anything else, Josh or Becky?
I guess process-wise, was this going? Was this going to be on the informal on tomorrow or
no?
Okay.
I mean, I haven't seen.
I just had a lot going on.
Right.
So.
No, it's not.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Becky.
Okay. Next on our agenda is the status report on the comprehensive plan update to the 2008 Johnson County Land Use Plan. Josh sent an email to everybody. I don't want him to have to read that aloud to everybody at the meeting. Everybody should know where we're at. I think the question is just from the board is where do we want to head next? So Josh, looks like you got some.
Right. So I guess I was hoping you guys would sort of take this conversation and get us started. I have some information here about some recommendations, but I'm curious to where, what you guys think of the email as a board, sort of where we left with ECI COG last Thursday.
I thought your decision made sense.
Okay.
So I'll leave that at that.
I wasn't happy with the product that we were delivered. It wasn't what I was expecting or the level of sophistication in analysis that I think that people of Johnson County deserve. And I understand that that this was not something that you were sitting in your chair when it happened. And so it makes sense to me to find a different way. The issue is that we may not have the correct amount budgeted. If we need to find a different way, it's probably going to delay us a few months, and you probably have some answers on that. But I'd rather get it right. I mean, if we're supposed to be creating a comprehensive plan that will last this county 10 to 15 years, I mean, there are people out there working on comprehensive plans that are 25 years old. I doubt this county is one of those in the future. But you know, at least 10 years, so it makes sense to me that we would do it right and we'd have a good product and the people could feel comfortable about the analysis that's been done. And so that's where I am. I realize it may cost a little more money.
And I guess one of the real issues at hand with the agenda is that the board has a contract with ECI COG and for the land use plan and the unified development ordinance update. With 30 days notice, either party can break the contract. And is that what the board wants to do? And if that is what the board intends to do, I have information, sort of some next steps that we plow forward.
Well, you asked them, could they deliver this project? And the answer was no. And so, from my perspective, they broke the contract, but regardless, you know, whatever it takes to move on, I think we should do.
So, Andy,
and they are on both agreements are on tomorrow's formal, so the board can vote to terminate. You voted to accept, so just to, for clarity of the record, I guess.
Are there any penalties?
Pardon?
There's no penalty. Correct.
No penalty. To the best of my knowledge, we've paid all our bills. I think ECI COG still owes us a few products.
not really going to press super hard to what they have us. But if the board does intend to vote to terminate the contract, this is how I am recommending that we go forward. So first off, we need to, it's essential that we hire a consultant. Staff isn't prepared to do this all on their own. So one, there's the time factor. And two, I think it's really important to have a consultant that, one, that has created comprehensive plans. You know, that's their job day in, day out. They create these plans. To be honest, I've been a planner for 10 years now, almost, and I have been on the tail end of one plan. So my expertise versus the expertise of the consultant that, you know, creates plans every day for counties and cities and regions, you know, it's going to be much greater. Just as, you know, they probably couldn't, you know, review a subdivision as well as Mitch could. But going forward, some of the things that would be essential in creating a new RFP, if that's what the board wants to do, and I'll talk about that in a
second. Before you go forward, I just wanted to say one thing. Not about the rest of the board, but I was not aware that there was any issues with DCI-COG on meeting the contract until a couple of days before the meeting here. If we were, did we ever have conversation with them saying they didn't feel things were up to par, that we weren't satisfied with what we were getting, if we were getting anything? I thought the update was
going to
be from them is where they were at.
So did I, Pat. And to be honest with you, we met several times, and I kicked their work back with corrections several times. And I've worked with DCI-COG in the past. I mean, they're...
And that's in the email that you got from Josh. I mean, it says that.
I did have some concerns, and I was really hoping that...
But it didn't address me.
There was a tiny thing, though, on that. I thought was weird too.
Right, and I was hoping that Chad Sands would show up and he would just, it would all be okay. But he didn't show up on time, and he sent Brock. And we're all aware how it went. I don't really want to, you know, drag that horse out of the barn and beat it again. But Pat, does that kind of answer your question?
It's safe to say that for a month or so you had concerns. But they knew the deadline, and you thought they would deliver in the end.
I was hoping that they would deliver it.
Okay.
So,
and when you asked him, would he be able to meet these expectations, the answer was no.
Right. I asked him, I was like...
That was after the board meeting.
I was like, are your goals for this plan and my goals for this plan, are they in alignment? You know, are you 100% committed? And it was no. That was the answer. And I think it was sort of... like, okay, well, you need to go to the board and see what happens. For right now, let's just stop all work. And, you know, I asked them to submit the materials that we had already paid for because of budgeting. I was trying to pay ahead a little bit to make sure that we had funds for the rest of it, because I was sort of having some concerns. Are we going to have enough to pay for the UDO update as well next fiscal year? So I was trying to get a little bit ahead, considering we budgeted 20, but it only spent $5,000. So, but if we do hire a consultant, which I am recommending, one of the things that I think we need to really look at, especially in this day and age and with the population of Johnson County, is communication materials, you know, branding, promotion, you know, a website design, posters, social media, someone to sort of take that and run with it. I think I sent an example of a plan in Story County and their website and how they're able to communicate the message and get out there with the public. That, I think, would someone be essential for any consultant. The consultant, they're going to play a major role in also working with staff.
Can we back up for a second, Josh? Because some of that stuff, to be honest, scares me a little. I mean, we have people that, Gary Yoder's very skilled in website and posters, and you know, we do a lot of social media. I just don't want to pay $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 for somebody to do what we can do in house.
And I don't think it's going to be so much pay an extra charge for it. It's, I want to say it's already worked in. But it also, I think it's the way that the consultant sort of uses to organize the plan and to communicate with staff. So all the materials, all the meeting notes, it's all public information anyway. That's one of the tools that they use to push that information out that's easily accessible to them, staff, and members of the public.
That all makes sense to me, and I agree with that. I just want to make sure we're not paying an exorbitant cost for it, because I think that can often happen.
and this is one of the things, any proposal that we get back, you can always, you know, can you itemize it? What are we paying for it?
Yeah.
What?
I mean, this is hiring a professional service. We're not required to go to public bid. We didn't when we hired the last one. And so, you know, you don't have to take the lowest bidder. You also, you could negotiate the price. You don't, you know, it just, and so, but I agree. I don't want to duplicate our own website and Mickey. But I get that their communication is different than what we do. I agree with not paying a lot of money for it. Okay.
So if we went down this path and ECI Cog was basically, we stop what we do and pay what we owe, you know, back, what's the timeline going to be moving forward, do you think?
To answer that, I can't tell you. Mike.
So all of those public hearings probably...
So all the town hall meetings that you all signed up for...
Yeah.
Take them off our calendar.
I would probably take them off your calendar. You know, there's no value being in an agricultural community. There's no value in starting anything, I think, prior to harvest season. It might be best, you know, because I don't think, one, we're going to get there and it's going to be so close.
Well, I don't want to concede that.
Yeah.
Because if we put this out, we got someone good, it may be possible to do some public input in August. I mean, you know, harvest season now is late September, early October. I mean, there's a lot of time between now and October.
And I did the liberty to call a few consultants that I know from the area, and I was like, so when can you start? I was like, July, August, and they're like, no, I don't know.
Yeah.
I am definitely in favor of let's get started as soon as possible.
I agree.
That's part of the issue. Yeah. We'll just have to play by ear.
Because I'm not going to say we wasted time, but we're behind schedule because we tried something that didn't work.
But we had allotted. This needs to be done by 18, right?
Yes.
And so we had allotted 24 months. We thought it would only take, you know, 15, so now it's going to, we'll still be able to be done in 18.
Right.
It's just a different calendar.
And in my initial conversations,
that's kind of what I was getting at. We'll still be able to
get
it done.
We still should be able to adopt this in the calendar year 18, right?
I think so, yes. And in my initial conversations with those same consultants, they were like, let's get this done in a year. We don't need to drag it out. We can do it. We can...
So they may not want to start until November, but get it done in a year that's fine.
And we may, I don't know, we also may want to adjust the advisory committee, or if that's the name of it, that we're, that's open till middle of June. It's the 20-person,
that's a good point. We could
leave it open another month if we wanted. Yeah, because if we're not going to need it. But I want to do this right.
Well,
and if we've left, we actually have a little bit of bunch of room in there. And if they can do it in a year, well, we actually need it done somewhere about in 2 years from now. So we have time. Let's just make sure we do it right now.
Right, and I don't want to overpromise it. Yeah. These were very initial conversations.
Right. And how about budgeting for this?
Well, on that calendar, it wouldn't matter because we budgeted in 16, we budgeted in 17, and if we moved it to fiscal year 18, right? So some of those bills wouldn't be due for a third fiscal year, and so we would just budget the amount we agree on. If for some reason it all came that we had to pay every bill in fiscal year 17, in theory, they're going to have so much extra revenue from building permits that we just amend the budget at the time. I don't think it's a big deal.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. No problem.
So going forward, just the rules, public meetings, open houses, and surveys, develop the plan in collaboration with staff. Whatever happens, staff is going to be closely involved, work very closely with the consultant. So I don't want to communicate any message that staff is going to play a hands-off role. So that is not the case. But we need someone to sort of advise us and take the bulk of just the day-to-day communication and operations regarding the plan. And then
in. You know, public involvement, do we generally probably 5 town hall meetings, plan for 4 public hearings, so 2 with P&Z Commission, 2 with the Board of Supervisors, or 1 and 3, depending on how it goes forward. 2 open houses to show a near final draft of the plan. What type of informal outreach do we want? Budget. You know, we need to figure out what are we willing to budget for. And I can go back and work with Dana and see kind of what we have and you know, what we can do. We need to do a budget amendment to figure out what budget. But at the end, I'm going to ask for some direction. What is the board comfortable with budgeting? And then location of the consultant, that's essential too, because a large bulk of the fees that are paid are due to travel expenses. You know, if they are driving from Des Moines or the Twin Cities, you know, there we got to pay, you know, hourly rate, their gas, probably hotel accommodation, and then back it all up and reverse it, which is, you know, that's you know, that could be, you know, 10-20% of the cost. I mean, travel is not cheap, and we essentially, you know, they budget for that, or whether they're sitting there writing the plan or they're driving, listening to XM radio on the way down from the Twin Cities.
Well, there's another,
paying $100 an hour.
There's another piece that, you know, when it's your own nest, you treat it a little better. You know, so somebody from Eastern Iowa, if they do a good job, they know that we're going to say they did a good job and the locals will hear it. If they do a really poor job, the locals are going to hear it. So I think there's a lot of value. You know, if you're from the Twin Cities, you can come do a poor job and go back to the Twin Cities and nobody is any wiser. So I think there's some value to local if you can
and I would
can find the right people.
I would prefer local, you know, walk to their own.
There's other variables, obviously, yeah. But all things being equal, I like local.
And the lifespan, one of the things that we might be interested in doing before, it's always been 10 years to another point. You know, what if we did a plan for 20 years and did a reassessment? So essentially we would just do an update of our comp plan, you know, do a reanalyze it, look at it again, and possibly, you know, see if the plan's working and what do we want to tweak. This is...
I don't have a master's in urban regional planning. And I didn't stay at a Holiday Inn Express, but what I know is that... this county has dramatically changed in the last 10 years, and every indication is that it will dramatically change again in 10 years. And whether that's in the unincorporated area or in the cities, I don't know the answer to that. So what I wouldn't want to do is spend a lot of time and resources trying to predict what's going to happen in 19 years, because I'm relatively confident they're going to be wrong. I mean, because we far exceeded the last prediction on population, you know, I mean, North Liberty is just blowing this out of the water. And so I'm going to leave that up to you to make the recommendation, but I'm more comfortable in the 10 to 15 than I am in the 20. I do think they should have a chapter or whatever, paragraphs, a section on the broader vision, a 20-year vision, but that's not necessarily the plan itself.
Right.
It's more of, we believe this is what's going to happen, but you're out of my, I don't know anything about this,
to me,
basically.
You plan for 20 years or even out. But just like this last plan, we planned 10 years, and it was up for review, and if it was working fine, you could extend or make some changes. Or you can rewrite the whole thing. We've chosen to rewrite and we do the whole thing. So I still think you want to be happy.
And
that mode.
And this whole idea of the 20-year plan, I think that it's sort of rather new. In the past, it's always, I think, been 10 years, and now they're thinking, well, do 20.
And I think more and more people are doing plans 20, 30 years, but with no intention of them actually lasting that long. Just have that kind of long-term vision, considering further into the future with the thought that halfway through that time, there's a possibility they're going to start all over. So that's just something I think we want to think about, maybe talk about.
You guys are the experts. Give us a recommendation.
Well, and you don't even have to know the answer now.
I think I would rather, you know,
we can hire someone and then we can have a discussion with them, you know.
No, I think about, especially in transportation issues, I'm thinking 30, 40 years in advance when I talk about 380 and things like the Crandic line and all sorts of things. So you have to think that far ahead, but you, a lot of times you need a one-year plan and a five-year plan and a 10-year plan, and because it's really hard to plan for 20 years. That's too far out. But you can envision for that far.
You can envision and then you plan to not sort of cut yourself off at the knees to do something that's going to enter that determination.
So,
UDO update. This is still up in the air. You know, our UDO needs to reflect our new comprehensive plan. Our UDO, it needs a update. I mean, we have permitted use and repair of typewriters.
Well, we just did this how long ago?
Well, we've done lots of, 2000, we recodified because we had so many amendments. Like, there's like 30-some amendments in just a few years. So we needed to recodify our ordinance and put everything together. Because before it was, you know, you'd look at the old one and you see, like, well, that doesn't make sense. You got to refer back to this page. And sometimes it was all buried in something else.
I can't remember. At one point I counted it. There have been like 21 amendments since I've been a supervisor. I mean, that's not a bad thing. It means it's a living document. But it does make sense to me. This is a comprehensive plan that the Unified Development Ordinance would have to be updated to reflect the plan. But that has to be done by a consultant and not in-house.
It's something that we could do in-house, I think, or maybe a combination of a little bit of a consultant and a lot of in-house.
So could you write Could you write the RFP that said we may continue this contract to do the Unified Development Ordinance, but that's, we understand that it'd be an additional fee and let them bid on it, but not necessarily agree to it today?
I think
tomorrow
we could do that, certainly. And, you know, when I say the UDO update, I envision, you know, adding zoning districts that are going to reflect some of the ag tourism uses. Reflect economic development standards. The county is looking for higher densities. You know, we're getting away from, you know, 1 acre lots. There's, even now, I'm just like, 1 acre individualized system. You know, it's, you know, where the county is sort of moved towards, you know, shared systems and smaller lots. But one of the issues is, and you remember this from Invite 3 or 4, whatever we're up to now, out there on 380 past Solon, is the setback requirements don't really sort of mesh with having higher densities, because we can't achieve the setbacks that are required with smaller lots, so we have to go back into variances. And so those are some of the updates that will be necessitated from this new comprehensive, just to name a few. Plowing ahead, so the framework, and we already saw this was what I floated to ECI COG, and they put in the analysis was some of the chapter sustainable development, economic development, the items that we're going to address, sort of subchapters, transportation, infrastructure, quality of life, and of course, land use. And then the next steps, so need direction, can formulate an RFP, or we can just go out and hire a consultant. Again, we can, you know, however we want to be, I can talk to them, you know, interviews, you know, before the board, you know, they can come do a presentation, sort of quasi-interview before the board. I know that there are some people interested, but I think the word's already out on the street about some of the, you know, predestined the direction of the board, but see the writing on the wall.
I always err on the fact of give everyone a chance to bid on it. That doesn't mean you have to pick the low bidder, but it makes sense to me to shop it around, not just make a few phone calls.
And to be honest, with my vision of what I would like to see is put out an RFP, and then that consultant is going to come and they're going to present to the full board at a work session. This is what we can do. Here's our price. And then you're going to get a sense of, you know, what they can do, how they, you know, their graphics and their visual aids, how they communicate. They'll get a sense of,
we can do that.
The staff. I mean, that would be my preference.
I like that.
And, you know, of course, you know, we'll, I'll I'll vet, you know, who whatever respond to and make sure that they're in line with their general requirements. Timeline, you know, I put immediately after harvest. I don't know. It's all going to decide on when we can get it done and when they can fit it into their work plan.
I would not, in RFP, tell them the timeline except for we need to have all these things written and adopted in by the end of 2018. Because if their bid could be $10,000 lower if we start in November or $20,000,
yeah,
then
don't force a timeline.
Or if they said, look, we really want to start in January, but we promise you we'll be done in 17, then I'd like to consider that, you know. If it works out with their, you know, better for them to do it next year and we get a better price, and but their total attention. So I wouldn't, as long as we're done by the end of 18, I think we're all good. That's where I am.
I agree with that. Also, we have a land use plan, not a comprehensive plan.
You do.
What the other factors that go into a comprehensive plan that are not in a land use plan, Josh, what are those?
It's economic development, I think.
You just went through the chapters.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Very, I mean, our land use plan, it addresses it kind of.
Yeah.
I mean, our land use plan is only like 28 pages long.
Yes.
We can envision this document is going to be 100 pages.
Yes.
I don't know. Yeah. But it's going to be really focused on economic development.
Right.
How do we want to accomplish? What are the board's goals?
And there are standards.
Standards.
The state now has requires a comprehensive plan, which has some you know, there's a set of things that they ask you to discuss. It's it's not stuff we haven't talked about before, but it's really just kind of putting it all in one document, right?
Yeah, prescribed.
Yeah.
So, and I'll go ahead, and I have some RFP samples that we can just, so here's Dorman, Oklahoma, Cleveland County.
Just one more question, Josh.
Yes.
You talked about transportation costs. Are there consultants in Johnson County or Eastern Iowa, like Cedar Rapids, that are qualified to do this sort of work?
I think so.
Great.
I don't. I think definitely there's some qualified consultants.
You made a couple calls to find out.
I did.
So you know them all. So the answer is yes.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and working with people that have home field knowledge, so to speak, that are from here, I think that don't have to come in and learn the lay of the land, I think is would be advantageous.
Yeah, but sometimes there are some assumptions made too. If you
yeah.
The land too well.
So I guess these are just some sample RFPs. This one is 15 pages.
I mean,
not my thing.
Yeah, I don't need to see the samples.
And then cost, I think, from like calling around, asking around, I think we can do it less than 70. We were in.
That's a huge stand. How do you zero in on the 70?
Well, I just asked Mitch to give me some data.
No,
it would cost me $25K and $300K. It
costs $300,000 probably to do it in LA.
Right, big cities. So the only thing, so eventually we'll read the RFP and we'll vote on it. So I'll read it when you get it written. But the only thing on there that I'd like clarified a little bit is if you go back to the communications part, wherever you have that, I would like the ability for people to issue comments interactive some way, you know, not just have to show up in a meeting, not just email. I mean, so it could be email, it could be an online version. I mean, I'm not entirely, but the next generation doesn't show up for meetings. So whatever we're getting from them and whatever we can work out in our own IT department, I'd like comments to flow through cyberspace.
Okay. That's something that's very important to us too.
And so if you could just spell that out, but that doesn't mean I want to pay $20,000 for some new, you know, widget or whatever those things are called on my phone.
Apps.
What else do you need from us, Josh?
So I guess I'll come to the meeting tomorrow and see where you guys go and if you guys go to terminate the contract with EC
CTI cost for the land use plan, then I will immediately then write in the RFP, and I'll get it on, work with Amy to get it on a board agenda. I'd probably say I'm going to need, you know, two weeks.
I mean, I don't necessarily, I don't know how other board members feel. I don't need it to be on a work session.
Yeah.
I mean, I trust that you can write an RFP. I want to get it out there. So, you know, to me, it can easily go informal. I don't know, do other folks feel the same? Or...
Sure. I mean, because if there's something on the informal we don't like, we can just rewrite it in that week. I mean, if it's a typo or a confusion or...
I mean, I appreciate the fact that you want, you know, input on this kind of thing, but I think you guys are very capable writing that RFP. I don't need to oversee that closely.
Great.
Anything else for Josh or Mitch?
I don't have anything else.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Okay. I see our folks are here for item number 6, so let's go ahead and move to that.
Wait, yeah. I have like 2 minutes.
Oh, yeah. Let's go ahead and take a quick break, and then we'll come back, and we will jump ahead to item number 6 on your agenda, which is the bridge.
Sure. Yep. Okay. Sounds great.
Okay.
That's all I know at this point.
Okay. Kimberly, are you ready? Michael, be fashionably late here.
That's a good question.
Let's go back into session. We are on item number 6 on our agenda. We're going to skip number 5 for right now. And we are talking about the results of the inspection and weight limit on Highway 965 bridge over the Iowa River, including next steps and future plans. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, everybody. Greg Parker, County Engineer.
Tim McDermott, Consultant with BJ Engineering, Structural Engineer.
Rob Winstead, Assistant County Engineer. Okay, and following with the agenda as it is set forth, I thought we would start off with Tim going through the process of the inspections and where we're at up to this point. So,
right. I'm going to start off with where we're at right now, the specific issue that forced the lane closure. Then back up a little bit, look at some of the inspection records over basically since I've been doing it, since 2009, and then finish up with what are our next steps, where do we go from here. So this view was taken a couple days ago. You're looking south from the center of the south span where the worst problem was located. You can see a dashed yellow paint line around the exterior of that patch. The reason for that is we're trying to really nail down the rate of deterioration right now. One of our inspectors that was first on scene said that within the matter of an hour, you see new cracks form. The patched area right there, it's kind of hard to tell from the photo, but it's actually a big hump in the middle of it. I'll do some explanation of what we think happened there. There are, as you know, other issues with the bridge, but I'm going to focus right now on what spearheaded this closure. The underside of the bridge there in that same location, this photo isn't spectacular, it doesn't show any major deterioration, but the crack with the efflorescence is telling us that water is getting all the way through the deck. This is the same spot looking in the other direction with a cross-section view shown below. How this type of bridge functions: steel girders have what's called a shear stud welded to the top of them. Those function to create adhesion between the steel girders and the concrete deck. When they're designed compositely. So the assumption is you have strength with them acting together. The little blue area is the delaminated area that you see that's been patched. The concrete has separated from the steel at the top of the girders, at the shear stud, and the deck reinforcement.
Excuse me, on that one you were just showing, was that cut out and bashed at one time, or was that just the damage?
I have no record of that being done. I know just the asphalt patching has been done. So this is kind of an exaggerated photo just to give you an idea of the mechanics going on. Put a wheel load directly on top of that delaminated area. You have downward force from the wheel load. Newton's third law tells us there's an equal and opposite reaction. So at the girder, it's pushing up, and then you get off there, which tells us that that deck and that girder aren't acting as one. At that point, we can conclude that the load carrying capacity of the bridge has been compromised. Looking back through the inspection report, since I've been doing them since 2009, we go back to 2010, the deck was rated as 6, superstructure 6, substructure 7. The recommendations that came out of that inspection, just to patch a few of the minor deck spalls, which at that time were completed by the county. And then the girders, some of the paint was beginning to flake off near the abutments, not nearly to the extent that we see today. 2012, we noticed that the delaminated areas were continuing to grow, so we downgraded the deck to a 5. Superstructure and substructure remained similar condition, so there was no need to downgrade them at that point. Recommendations that we gave were to replace the entire deck within 5 to 7 years, and then zone the girders within 5 to 7 years. All of the items that are shown in red, those are all responses from the county. So they responded to that inspection report and placed the bridge in 2013 on the 5-year plan.
So, okay, a layperson question.
Sure.
What's the difference between, I can make up the answer, but I'd rather you tell me, a superstructure and a substructure?
Good question. It's easy with a type of bridge like this. You have bearings. It's a mechanical device that transfers the load from the girders to the gear. Everything above the bearings is considered the superstructure, except the deck. The deck is looked at as added.
So I always, and this is my problem, I've been using the wrong term. When we did Mahaffey Bridge, I said superstructure needs replaced, and that to me was take it down to the water and start all over. And that's wrong. The superstructure is actually what's above. It's the substructure that's what's below.
Should be what's above. At Mahaffey, we know you have the big fancy diagonals and an overhead pier. That's actually part of the substructure.
Because it's controlling the weight.
Correct.
All right, so in this bridge...
I would use Mahaffey as an example.
In this bridge, the piers and whatever are what you're calling the substructure.
Substructure.
And then the stuff above these, quote, bearings are the superstructure.
Correct.
Okay.
With the exception of the deck, that's given.
That seems backwards to me, but
so
that's right.
So kind of like, if it's weight bearing, it's substructure?
Well, it's all weight bearing.
Okay.
Just,
so the superstructure, I'm struggling with that part.
Superstructure is what is supporting the deck. So you have the deck supported by the girders, and then
everything
the piers support the girders.
And if you look at this photo here, the beams and the deck, that's the superstructure. So what we see there is effectively the superstructure on this.
Okay.
And whatever sits below those beams is the substructure.
Okay. Now I've got it. Below is sub. Now, if you change that definition, you're going to mess me up. Some other bridge.
Stop me at any point that you want to clarify.
When you go back to your various bridge inspections, the superstructure, so that's what's above, is a 6 in 14. The substructure, so what's below, is a 7. And 10 is, oh, my God, it's falling down, right?
Yeah.
The other way around.
Okay,
so 1 is, oh, my God, it's falling
lower
down.
Lower numbers are worse.
Okay.
0 would be failed.
All right.
12 would be, oh my God, it's falling.
So does any used bridge basically score a 7?
No. I'll get into that in the next slide.
Perfect.
I have the federal guide.
That's perfect.
But I believe I stopped at 2012 there. So the following inspection, 2014, again, the only entity that's really changing is the deck. Downrated that to a 4 again. We noticed more areas that spalled out, and we determined that it was delaminated. The county actually sent out a crew to do what's called a chain drag. There's a specific sound that a deck makes when you drag a heavy chain across it. It's a hollow sound, and that's indicative of any area that's become delaminated. The idea is if you have a certain percentage of the deck area that's become delaminated, it needs to be replaced. And at that time, they found that it was over that threshold, which is 20%. So it was, that supported the action of placing it on the 5-year plan. Correct me if I'm wrong, Greg, that happened somewhere in the 2013 range.
I think it was then on 11-12.
Okay.
It was around that timeline. Because actually, when we were looking at the recommendations for the patch deck areas, at that point, then our crews would go out and drag the deck and make sure that we're tapping and or dragging and listening to those areas that are spalled, potentially delaminated, where we would have to chip out and move and then patch the concrete.
Correct. So again, in the 2014 inspection, the deck needed to be downrated again. The recommendations were just bringing the previous recommendations up to the current year, which would be replace the deck and zone paint thickers within 3 to 5 years. Following that inspection, the county hired BJ Engineering to do a rehabilitation options study just to see where exactly the direction of the rehabilitation needed to go. I'll get into that here in a little bit. The most recent inspection was actually not a scheduled inspection. That is scheduled for August. One of the county crew noticed something odd happening with the deck. Greg Parker called me almost immediately. We had one of our inspectors out at the bridge within an hour. I showed up about an hour after that. We found the deterioration on the southbound lane and made the determination that that lane needed to be closed. We investigated the soundness of the concrete in the northbound lane, and it's almost unprecedented how when you change over that center line of the road and you have sound concrete on the northbound lane, deteriorated concrete on the southbound lane. And part of the explanation for that is there's a construction joint running down the center of the bridge, which alleviated some of the stress from crossing over into that lane. That said, now that you're moving all traffic over into the northbound lane, that's certainly going to speed up the deterioration. So that's why we gave the recommendation that bi-weekly inspections happen from this point to a suitable fix. So, and then we also updated the rehabilitation project time frame to 0 to 2 years, which it did jump a year on the linear deterioration progression. And we also gave the recommendation of load posting the bridge at 20 tons, which the response time between noticing the issues and the county getting out there and closing down that southbound lane and getting it load posted is very fast, in my opinion. We have other clients that probably would have let this sit for a couple weeks before getting around to it. So, add on the back to everyone involved.
Is that north edge going to be the same size of the deterioration?
It is, but not indicative of a loss in load carrying capacity. I mean, it still has full structural adequacy in that there are a couple areas of spalling, but the areas that we were concerned about loss of structural capacity are isolated to the southbound lane at this time. That could change, though, again, now that all the traffic is over on the northbound lane. So that's the idea behind the biweekly inspections.
Well, you showed us that one picture from underneath toward the beginning. Yeah, so that crack is going, that's southbound, and it's going towards the northbound, but you said it's that center. Is it that beam right there then that's keeping it from going?
Yeah, it's going transverse, so
perpendicular to the span of the bridge.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so in other words, towards the northbound. Right, isn't that over there farther from it, or at the bottom, the northbound? Where the white is southbound, correct?
Where the pointer is. Where the pointer is right here,
yeah.
That's the northbound lane.
Well,
here's the
pointer.
Is
the northbound.
That's the,
wait.
I'm sorry.
That
center line of the bridge falls between these two girder lines here.
Okay.
Northbound right here, southbound, and southbound exterior.
Okay.
The crack, I mean, it's hard to tell from this photo, but it's actually initiating from this girder right here. It's kind of a hairline crack, and then it widens at this point.
Okay.
That widening of the crack is where you're finding the efflorescence.
Okay, so the widening of it is going away from the northbound.
Correct. I mean, that's...
But...
That's how...
It started closer to the center.
Correct. That's where the wheel load and the upward force of the girder right there. Cracks begin as a hairline and propagate out. That's why you don't
so
see.
So they never link them going the other way?
Because there's that construction joint at the center of the bridge, it almost stops at that point, and all the cracks head to the exterior portion of the deck.
But the top of the bridge is all one. It's not. The top of the bridge isn't separated. It's all one top.
Correct. Correct.
So it could.
Well, I mean, what
could.
With all due respect, I don't think we're going to, I mean, I can't do 7 years of engineering school in the time we have
20
here.
Minutes, yeah.
So, I mean, I just, well, I appreciate the interest in mechanically what's happening. I think we have to talk about, we got to get to where we're going to go here. So
yeah, certainly. I just,
yeah,
you know,
no, I understand
an explanation for what's going on. There's
was warranted because I want to know if that, you know, what kind of escalation might we see in the crack? And that, well, that's why I asked the question. Okay.
Well, I think to a certain extent that has been alleviated by moving traffic off that.
You know, from my perspective, ask any question you want. That's why we're here.
Yeah.
So if you felt like the rest of us were upset, I'm not.
No.
I am actually very interested in why the crack is ending at the center line. I think that's an important.
The purpose of those construction joints is to alleviate stress. Now,
so because it's not
one,
flexing, it's I'm going to use layperson's terms. It's flexing on the southbound lane, and that's contributing to the crack. It's not doing that on the northbound lane, so the crack isn't crossing over. It may, and that's why you want to do every other week inspections, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And that's just a preventative measure. Decks are extremely unpredictable. We can...
Yeah, that's why I asked the question.
They go through many complicated forces. You put salt down. They go through freeze-thaw cycles. Once you've penetrated the top of it, you get water intruding, especially a bridge this old doesn't have epoxy coating on the bars, which protects it from corrosion. You start to see
rapid deterioration. Should I move on, or? So, here is the federal coding. That's really small text, and I apologize for that. Just to alleviate any confusion between what these numbers mean, when we go from a 4, which is poor condition, which the deck was previously coded at, you see advanced section lots, deterioration. And it became appropriate to downgrade it to a 3. This is a serious condition. It is a primary structural element. We have indication of deterioration, cracking, and then it becomes warranted to load restrict it for most heavy, the heaviest trucks out there, which by posting it at 20 tons, we've effectively done that. Here's a diagram of Iowa's legal trucks. Again, I apologize for the text being so small. Every one of these, the smallest truck on there is a Type 4. That's 27 and a quarter tons. All of the other range from, all of the additional trucks on there are 40 tons. So we've taken the heaviest trucks on the road off there.
So if the smallest one is 27 tons, that already exceeds our weight limit.
Correct.
So basically, you can say no trucks. I've seen trucks up there. I saw trucks up there when I was up there.
Well, that becomes an enforcement issue then.
Exactly.
But, so,
and a safety issue.
It's all 20 tons, because we asked this question and Rob was struggling because he's not the maintenance guy last week, but one of our trucks, not loaded, does that weigh 20 tons?
Yes.
So our truck itself weighs 20 tons.
What kind of, so what kind of truck is that one? It's 27. What, I mean, like, can you compare it to something that?
These are what's called ASHTO. Actually, the Type 4 is a little bit different. Iowa specifically came up with that one. These are all fictitious. They're not. It's designed by ASHTO or the Iowa Bridge Office to produce the worst case scenario.
And the top truck that you see with the front single and the 3 behind it, the very top one, that would be a tandem axle dump truck with what we call a cheater axle on it, so they can push the cheater axle down and spread the load so that they can be a legal load for driving purposes. None of our trucks have that, but that would be an example of what that could be.
So, I mean, that raises the question that we have a problem, we need these vehicles off of that, we're going to need to enforce it. And so, have you been in contact with the sheriff's office? About enforcing. I mean, it took us a little while to get people to comply with Mahaffey Bridge, but it only takes a few sirens and they start learning not to come this way.
Okay. Who suppose that's done with DOT going that way?
I'm just saying, I live out there. I've seen plenty of trucks. I walked out there the other day. I've been out there 3 times now since the closure, and there are trucks going across. And they're not small. And, you know, I don't know how they compare to the smallest one you have here. But it just seems
if it's semis, you'd be down in the 40-ton range. So this becomes an enforcement issue. And
we better do something.
Yeah. At this point, the bridge is load restricted. Warn the public. So, moving forward, in 2015, we were hired to do rehabilitation options study, and we looked at a couple different options, one of which was to widen the deck to 40 feet. We went through the analysis and determined that the existing piers could not support that additional weight, so that immediately became an infeasible option. Option 2 on there was to widen the deck to 30 feet above its current, I believe it's about 24. found that the Greers and the peers could adequately support that. And as part of that project, would also include some miscellaneous repairs to the piers, new guardrail, new drains, a new approach pavement, and that came in at about $2 million. Now, this is 2015, late, I think it was early 2015 dollars, so certainly material costs have gone up since then, and we're looking at any kind of an accelerated construction schedule. Contractors typically charge you a premium for that. So just as a little caveat to that estimate there. But no design was done at that time. It's just a preliminary analysis.
How wide is the deck now?
It's approximately 24 feet. So if we're redecking the whole thing, we are required to bring it up to current code, which has to be at least 30 foot wide.
And the lanes, and then there's the shoulders, so 30 to 15 foot on each side from the center line. 11 foot lanes, 12 foot lanes.
I believe it's 12 foot lanes, and then there's
4 foot shoulder.
Yeah, right now there's currently basically no shoulder.
But when we talked about this in the five-year road plan year before last or whatever, unless you're going to tear down the whole bridge and start all over, you can't get a real separated trail on here.
Right.
And, you know, you can get a little wider, but bicyclists are still going to need to get across the bridge in the lane. And, I mean, it'll be a little wider, but you don't want to get squeezed because literally this is the rail.
Yeah.
And so at the time, we instructed them to put in the $2 million type project in the five-year road plan. And we talked about, real quickly, using some sort of signage. Bicycles will be entering lane, share the lane. I mean, whatever ASHTO says we can do. But it just wasn't feasible with the piers if we're going to try to get some more lifespan out of the piers. That's an if, which I assume you're going to get to.
Yeah, this, I certainly recommend that this is a good candidate for rehabilitation. As you saw from the previous inspection reports, the superstructure and the substructure, now that we've defined those, are in excellent condition for the age of this bridge. Once the rehabilitation project is done, it should tack on at least another 20 years of design life.
When was the last time the piers were inspected underwater?
I did it in 2008 after the high water event. And also 2011 when the water was down quite a bit. We didn't have a dive team, but I was able to wade out to the piers. There's never been any indication of scour or any kind of deterioration below the waterline.
We are on a prescribed requirement for sub-water investigations on these piers. And they are every 48 months, is that correct?
60
months. Thank you. So, some of the things that I try to work with our bridge inspector is that if the water levels are super low, and if I can talk him into putting waders on and walking out there and checking it, well, it's just assuring us that we're...
So, I mean, it's raining in different parts of the state, but the water is super low. And so before we put a nickel, I want to inspect it again. And I think it would be foolish to, because the last time you were out there was 11, you said? Or what? What date did you say? 13? I just don't remember what you said.
2011 was when I waded out.
Yeah. Oh. So
the water level is low enough that will occur.
So,
and I'm not certified as a diver. We would have to have a dive team.
Before we go down the path of anything, I want everything inspected again. I mean, that just seems to me to be a worthwhile investment. I don't know what that costs, but 11 was a long time ago.
Dave Wilson just told me they were holding back
additional water, so that it was actually just, it was muddy just the other day, and now it's up like 4 feet. So yeah, it would require a diver, I'm sure.
Was it 4 feet? I believe 6 feet is the actual.
I thought he said four. I mean, you could actually see the mud the other day, but and then that was yesterday. I spoke to him, so maybe it was on its way to six. I don't know.
We can certainly look at what the water elevation is and make that determination. I think you're absolutely right, though, before investing that amount of money. It's a requirement anyways. If I'm not sent out to inspect it, if it's low enough, then hiring a dive team to do it.
And this is the only bridge that we have that requires scour inspections in the county. Now, we've done scour inspections, as y'all recall, the Hills Bridge.
Yeah, I was going to say we did that.
The flows coming down that river are so high that, the flows are so high that we did have scour around the piers and the abutments. So we will go and repair those, and when we close the bridge, we have to do another inspection on
it. Well, if we're supposed to do it 60 months, it's now anyway. He last looked at it 5 years ago. So, yeah, so we should get that done. That's where I am.
And then the last alternative from that 2015 study was a pole replacement, which $4.5 million was what I came up with at that time. But when you're looking at a bridge that long, there's quite a range associated with that. So it could be anywhere from $4.5 to $6 million. But again, I don't recommend that just due to the good condition of the substructure and superstructure. And this is basically just showing the main scope of rehabilitating it with a 30-foot deck, remove and replace the entire deck, zone painting the girders. What zone painting means is that they're not in bad enough condition that it's going to require repainting them entirely. There's just spotty areas, typically around deck drains, where there's a lot of pack rust, so that would need to be cleaned and then removing and replacing the approach pavement that's been cracking and buckling for quite some time. There's some spalling on the pier caps that'll need to be either patched or re-poured. And then there's also a couple areas of spalls, exposed rebar on the pier faces that are mainly a cosmetic issue, but we want to, before water can infiltrate the pier faces, we want to have those patched. And then also the bearings would need to be cleaned. There's quite a bit of pack rust on those as well. We can turn around a design project and plan preparation, everything you would need to put out for a local letting within 45 days.
Really? I saw that when you flipped to that screen, because it seems like we can't design anything in 6 months.
This is extremely aggressive, and we've prepared
all our
people.
We would be paid for that? I mean, this schedule? Yeah.
There's certainly a cost associated with plan development schedule that aggressive, but we've made all our people available, deprioritizing other projects to be able to get this out the door.
A couple of questions.
Sure.
First is, we had discussions in 2008 that drill holes in the bridge for water coming up, get the water and air pressure out going in. At that time, we discussed we were replacing, we wanted to raise it by a foot. Now, is it feasible to do that, or is it better off just having holes built in that as you pour it rather than having to drill holes through the concrete?
I remember that issue. That comes up when you have a concrete girder bridge, because you have a buoyant force that can essentially lift the bridge up, so you need to alleviate that holes in the deck. This is because it's a steel girder bridge. You're not going to have the same buoyant force. You don't have, they're called diaphragms. They're essentially the transverse beams that go in between the beams. You don't have those full depth. So if the water comes up, there's the buoyant pressure is alleviated. I don't. Has the
road ever been overtopped here?
The road has.
The road has.
I thought you drilled, not you, I thought the county drilled holes in it in 08. Is that not true?
We drilled multiple structures during that high flow event.
I thought we did.
I was thinking that 965 was drilled, and that was under Shane Driscoll's recommendation at that time.
I can't speak to that.
Yeah, wasn't.
So the only way to raise it is to tear it all down and start all over, right?
I don't believe it needs to be raised. We'll certainly look at the hydraulics and make that determination. But
no. I mean, it was closed in 08.
Right.
So if the county wanted it to never close again, we'd have to raise it. And the only way to do that is to tear it all down and start all over, right? You can't just...
Well, they could build up on top of the pier. DOT would do that.
Again, we'll have to reevaluate the hydraulics, but there hasn't been any indication that the design high water overtop the road often enough that it needs to be raised up. If it does need to be raised significantly, then we're back to reevaluating the substructure to determine if it has the capacity to hold that.
Yeah, and that's a whole different ballgame money-wise. I mean, this is...
So you would do the dive inspection, whatever you call that, take a look at all the girders and piers and whatever again.
What we're looking at with a dive inspection is the underwater elements. So,
okay, so when's the last time you inspected all the piers and girders, and was that just last week?
No, because that was a special inspection, not the scheduled inspection. You're only looking at the issues that were raised
okay.
by the county.
So
2014
if we told you we wanted all the piers and girders and the scouring inspected, can you get that done?
Because we are contracted with you already to do that, which is scheduled for August, we can bump that up, add, if necessary, the dive inspection. I'd like to save you money and just go out and do it myself. But
if you, because what I don't want to do is, we're working on 14 information. We move forward on this deck replacement, and you tear it all off, and you're like, oops. And so... Right now, the substructure and the superstructure are rated as such from the 14 inspection that it makes sense to just do the redecking, the new deck, and we'll buy 20 years for the people of Johnson County. But if you found a problem, I'd want to know that before we get too far down the road on this deck project.
Agreed.
And so I'd rather just get, and I don't know what we're talking about costs, but everything reinspected to make sure there's no unknowns. And then if that's true, that we're still in this 6 and 7 range, whatever those numbers were, then this redecking makes sense to me, and I understand that the $2 million was old numbers.
No, I agree, and I think that's an appropriate way to proceed. We can bump that inspection up to next week. We'll make the determination if those dives are necessary. I mean, your contract with us already includes that inspection, so that won't cost you any additional money. You have to hire divers. Then
that's fine.
That we'll just pass them whatever their fee is. But
it's to me, it's just the research we need to make sure that the whatever you're calling this, rehabilitation of the deck, is financially the best choice. And if you find out that things are still 6 and 7, then we have no worries on the substructure or the superstructure. A new deck would save this bridge for another 20 years, and we just put it out on that long-range plan. If you found a problem, then we'd be back to the drawing board, and we'd be talking about a $6 million project or something. And so.
Oh, I agree. That's a great way to proceed. And actually doing that rehabilitation project, that will bump up those numbers. I would uprate the girders and substructure based on the condition that brought it up to by doing those.
And just for your all information, every scour inspection that I've done or had completed since I've been here, we've never had a scour problem on the structure. The flow is very low, and actually we were talking about finding out how we can have that go away just because we don't really see the need to do it, but it's not that we're not going to do it. So we'll continue on until we can get approval from NHI or the DOT as our bridge oversighter and see if it really is needed, because we never, ever have a scour problem on it.
When you redo the deck, you have to close the bridge entirely. You don't do half the time, right?
Correct, yes. Yeah, it will need to be closed.
What would you anticipate the length of the project to be once you close and start working on it, assuming that you don't have catastrophic rain?
We really can't make that determination until we investigate it a little more. I'd be hard-pressed to come up with a number for that.
Because you know that's what people are going to be asking us.
Yes.
Yep.
I'd be happy to tell you once we dig into it a little deeper.
So you said local letting. If we use money we have in reserves, we can use a local letting and not a DOT letting, right? Because it's not farm to market money. It's not federal bridge money. It's just total local money. Either our fuel tax money or other money that we just haven't. Projects sometimes are over budget and some under, and we have a fairly healthy reserve. So it could go out, and then as soon as this was ready, it could go out to bid, right? I mean, there's no state or federal laws that.
Well, Rob, you want to take the answer to this?
Well, yeah, I see where you're asking. Just some background. After we got that lane closure established Friday and got the immediate situation under control, we've been working since then to figure out how we can fast track this project, what the timeline would be, and what issues we'd have to cross. The first thing we determined after talking with the DOT, several people at the DOT, is the DOT is more than willing to work with us to expedite a project on their DOT timeline. But the reality, even with their help and expediting it as much as they can, we'd still be looking at a October or November letting. So right then and there, that kind of sent the message to us that we would have to forego the federal money, use that. We have a plan B in place. We've been looking at that. Use that federal money on different projects at a different time.
Good. So that's doable.
When Tim said local letting, that's the result of that background information. Now, what we're also working on is we've already got inspections in place for checking the existing bridge out for asbestos. If you have asbestos in that bridge and you have to abate that, that's something we need to find out that can certainly affect the project schedule. We've got those same folks investigating the paint. You know, what's the parts per million of lead in the paint, and they also look at chromium. So we're waiting to find out some of that so we can help determine what kind of schedule we're looking at. We're also setting up a meeting to look at threatened and endangered species, and we're trying to meet someone out there yet this week to give it a preliminary scan for that. Now, our intention is that we don't expect to have any major environmental issues, but we still have to make sure. If we're staying out of the water, we're not buying right away, you know, we really shouldn't have any wetlands issues. Since we're working just basically on the road top, we think we're okay with like archaeology studies and stuff that we can, you know, get through that without any hurdles, but we still have the threatened and endangered species issue to check out. The last time we did that, they included a list of all those in their report. You know, we've got to look for birds. Of course, you've all been aware of the bats, but we have birds, bats, fish. I mean, fish, obviously, we should be fine with. Mussels, we should be fine with. But we also have plants and insects. So without getting somebody out there to tell us if we have to deal with any of that, that's going to affect our schedule.
Snakes.
Snakes, yeah, that's on the list. So I wish I could lay out a schedule of, like, here's when the design's done, here's the letting date,
here's how many construction working days we would give them, and here's when they would complete it, but we're still working towards that. And, you know, I would hate to present any dates to you that, you know, could be significantly affected by some of these things that we're in the process of figuring out. I feel like I got five or six plates spinning on a stick, and I need to get some answers so I can, you know, not do you a disservice by throwing out dates that, you know, we're going to come back a week later and say, oh, darn.
The other issue is midwinter when you're working on it, I understand.
Yeah.
A good winter, you're okay. But just,
if you get into having to do cold weather protection for the concrete, I mean, it's very expensive. We also did our design locate call into the Iowa One call system. We have a huge utility conduit attached to the bridge and underneath the deck, so we've identified the utility companies in the area through that One call system. They got sent a letter yesterday telling them, here's what's going on with this bridge. We hope to expedite a project and get this deck replaced as soon as possible. Let us know if you have facilities out there, because they're going to have to be moved. So we've got all these things in the works, and we've got answers to some things, and we're waiting on answers to others. But I mean, Tim obviously has given you a report on, if he mobilizes his whole office, what he's hoping for a design schedule. But, you know, if asbestos is out there or any of these other things, that could affect what the plans.
It was on the Happy Bridge, right? Small amounts of asbestos, but it was there, and this was built at the same time. Yeah. So, I mean, who knows?
Well, we can, from our office, we can proceed with just pushing that inspection up and getting that taken care of early next week, because it sounds like that should be job one. Following that, we can give a more meaningful scope for what is it, us as a consultant need to achieve prior to giving you any kind of dollar number for that.
That's it. More questions from the board?
I just think we need to bring
more information.
Well, so what you need from us is consensus to hire VJ Engineering to do this rush design plan, right? So my question, I had it earlier on the budget amendment, is all of these inspections, the lights that are up, and this immediate design plan, do those need to be amended into this budget before June 30th, or do they need to be amended into next year's budget from reserves?
I think that we
because the construction won't be this year, right. But everything to get us to a construction document, the bills may start coming due now.
But that 45 days takes us into.
So I am not going to briefly chat about it, but I don't think there's a need for us to add any additional amendments to the budget to correct or anticipate additional bills coming in before the end of this
fiscal. Okay.
So I think we're okay, but next year, certainly, we are going to have conversations about amendments, and we all know this is coming. So.
And we have planned for design fees for this bridge in our FY17 budget. Now, whether that covers it or not is yet to be seen with an expedited schedule, but we do have a budget item for that beginning July 1st.
So at least part of it.
Yeah.
Are there any requirements have an engineer to respect to quotes from different ones, or would I just do
It's a professional service, so you can hire an engineer, just anyone you want.
Correct. Unless you're using federal dollars, then you have to look at it.
So
if we're using federal dollars to pay the consultant, which we've never done.
If we just tell you, go ahead and hire a VJ because they're already half done, then you're good, right?
Well, certainly we'd have to have a contract proposal from them, and then Andy Chappell would have to do a quick pass over, and then if you're giving me authorization to sign that contract, I can certainly do that, or if we would like to bring that back for your approval and signature from the chairperson.
We pretty much always do chair sign off on it, but we're not going to slow it down. I mean, we'll go as fast as we can go.
Yeah, I am okay with you negotiating a contract and putting it on straight on formal meeting whenever you need to do that and get it done because so they can start working.
So prior to us putting that together, we're going to get this inspection done. When next week would you need that by the proposal? I mean, I can get it up.
I always refer to Andy on scheduling and finding out if the board would want us to come back during your normal Thursday meeting. That's pushing us out of an additional week that we may lose, but if we could expedite that once we get the bearing, Andy's not here, so I hope he's in town to be able
to do it as fast as we need to do it. I mean, we meet every Wednesday and Thursday.
Right.
And so, you know,
in order to put a contract on the agenda, you have to have 24-hour notice, but we can agenda a formal meeting on Wednesday. We can agenda, I mean, so three of us can come in on a Friday at midnight if that's what it takes.
So you were asking, though, when to go out there, right?
Well, basically, what I'm hearing, correct me if I'm wrong,
I mean, as soon as it's practical.
Yeah.
I mean, we can put the contract on an agenda before the actual contract's ready. I mean, it just needs to be ready by the time of the board meeting.
Yeah. Right. There's not a whole lot of time associated with putting together a proposal. It's just I want to get out there and inspect it thoroughly before doing that. Because if there's something glaring that we see that wasn't there in 2014, that's going to entirely change the scope.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate
your
work.
Thank
you for coming in.
Thank you all for your time last week. I know these things are unforeseen and certainly not expected from our standpoint, but all of us here appreciate your time. And
thank you, staff, especially. Thank you, Rob, for setting up this late.
Thank you.
Yep. Just very good news that everybody's okay. So. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, the next item on our agenda, we're going to skip back up to number 5, which is upcoming meeting of the Region 10 Policy Committee, including transportation alternative program funding and membership and representation of the Central Iowa Council of Governments and related committees. Andy, you're passing something out to us. What do we have here?
Well, and I could have emailed this, but I know some of you are having connectivity trouble, so I wanted you to have a copy. This is just, as I indicated by an email, in one of the prior discussions, the board had indicated that they wanted some public information requests out about the deliberation process or the vote on the trail funding. So yesterday I sent out requests to all the members of the Policy Committee and the Regional Trails Committee. And so I know the two of you are going to a meeting tomorrow afternoon. This is, so I just want to have a caveat. This is not a complete response. But I think it gives you, I thought it'd be helpful to have responses from a couple of the members, I think both from Jones County. So that's why I'm passing it out.
So, number one, there's confusion about who's going. I thought I was instructed by the board to go. I'm happy to get out of it. That's not true. Because there's some sort of email that Pat and Tom Braze are both going, and I would just be an alternate.
No, Tom's going just because if there's something that happens where Tom's expertise is needed, he can whisper in your ear.
Oh, that's not how I got that email.
But Tom's expecting, I mean, I spoke to him, and I think, Andy, you might have spoken to him as well.
I did.
Well, we were talking to him this morning. He thought that you were going to speak as just a member of...
He told me as a member of the public. And if so, then I'm just not going.
Okay.
No, well, I think we want Tom to be the member of the public, that just if there's something on where his area of expertise comes up during the meeting, we need him to weigh in.
Can you do that if he's...
That's what my question...
not an official alternate. I mean, if you set an alternate for him, he's there. It's kind of...
We can do anything we want.
Right.
He can sit there.
He sits on the committee, and we were going to send... And all of us are alternates, is correct?
Right.
And so it was on my understanding, and I guess I got that wrong, that originally I thought Janelle was going and Pat. And then Tom, understanding, and this might be what he says in the email, is that you were going to address the board and that you weren't going as an alternate. But he said that he doesn't have to go, and he probably could go. It just, is it appropriate for all three of them to be there?
Well, I think we want Tom to go,
yeah.
Because if there will be other items on the agenda, and it may have something to do with buses, and then we want
yes.
Tom there, but there's no reason he has to be the voting member.
Okay. So if I understand my instructions from the board, Pat and I are going as the voting member, and he sent me an agenda, but I haven't had a chance to read it, but I clearly will get it read, and Pat and I will vote on behalf of the county. Tom will just be there to give us advice. Okay. Now we need to decide from what you want us to say or do. I'm just thumbing through this, and clearly there was... I don't know how you get to a quorum, but clearly there's a conversation among counties to take the money away from Johnson County and Linn County, right? I mean, I can't read all this and talk at once, but...
Right, right.
So, did they violate open meetings laws or not? I mean, have we been able to count?
No. I mean, I've gotten maybe four or five responses that just went out yesterday, so... So I don't have all the information. I thought this was illustrative of at least the conversations that went on. And my understanding, I think that this would be the, this sheet would be the document that was prepared by Ed Raber
and
discussed with other.
We clearly had a meeting in April at 9 a.m. on a Friday.
With Jones County, right.
Right. And the question is, how many people were at this meeting?
And were there other meetings?
Right.
Right.
And did he have these meetings with other counties? That's...
Right. So, again, I assume more responses will be coming in. I can draw more of that, but since there was a meeting tomorrow, I thought these documents were, as I say, illustrative anyway.
So what constitutes a quorum for them?
Well, I mean, you've got a quorum of the board of this TAP, which is apparently different than the policy board, which who knew that before this started. And he gave us the TAP list, so I don't know how many, now I don't have it over here, but how many people were on the TAP?
Yeah, I can pull that up and figure it out. So it's the Region 10 Policy Committee, and then there's the Board of Directors of the ECOG, and then there's the Regional Trails Advisory Committee. So that's why in my email I kind of tried to lay that out, because I've always get these committees confused too. But it's the Policy Committee that.
And whatever we
voted
were
on
that. Whatever we were sent on that, can you hit print?
Sure.
This committee list to Pat and myself. So
that's the last page. Obviously, it's a page missing.
No, if you again, I think he copied off. You'll notice that there's one email that starts about three different times on that. Again, I think you just have to tell what's new. There's one long email from Brad Mormon, I think, that shows up at the bottom of several emails.
And what was the other county that voted with Linn and Johnson? Jones?
It wasn't Linn, it was Washington.
No, no, no. They voted with us.
Oh, with us.
Yeah.
Cedar.
Jones or Cedar?
Cedar.
Because it's interesting to me, there's a, one of these says, it's from the Johnson County Conservation, so Brad Mormon. From all of this, I would caution you about following Mr. Raber's recommendation in greatly eliminating funds. And so it ends up Cedar that votes with Lynn and Johnson, right? Not Jones. Okay. I'd say that's a big old mess. So what do you want Pat and I to say?
Well, one thing that I think Ed Raber needs to understand is that I have no interest in ever doing any business with his organization again. So that's me.
Is his economic development for Washington County or the city of Washington?
Washington County. Well, maybe both.
I'll print off the bylaws. I think there's this, not necessarily for tomorrow. I think there's a question whether or not he constitutes a valid member of the policy committee, because it's supposed to be someone, either an elected official or someone
so
accountable.
So will you print me the bylaws too? So a non-official.
That was in the packet. That
okay.
Sent, so.
So will you just print it all, because
yep.
I read some of that and I just was kind of overwhelmed. So is the message of Johnson County that we're extremely disappointed about how this process took place and outside of the normal scoring and review system and all of this backroom dealing, we are concerned that it violated open meetings laws and constituted a rolling meeting, and that we expect that I'm just making this up, so make sure you're okay with what I'm saying. That Johnson County expects our relationship with the members of the ECI COG planning to be professional and in public, and that the scoring mechanisms are important, and that if we're just going to throw them out and play politics with them, then we shouldn't even go through the steps. And that, make no mistake about it, that this situation has tainted our relationships with all of the entities that voted to throw out the scoring mechanism and play politics with this. Am I on the right track?
And we may want to talk with Lynn County about what we have to do to form a different region.
Okay. And with our entitlement money that comes to us because
yep.
of our population.
Yes.
Yep.
So
I think during that meeting it was pretty clear they had met with Benton County as well. I'm not seeing anything here.
Again, I haven't gotten all the responses.
They just, yeah, they've
so.
Got time to respond. They haven't done it yet. Maybe.
So if we say something like that, I have your permission to do that. I'm not speaking out of school.
No,
you're not going to go to the press and say
I'm
that dirty rotten no good, Janelle.
I think that we need to play hardball
okay.
here. And there, I was up for public shaming, too.
There's a set.
Well, there was a set way of scheduling for all these grants and funding, and they followed it. But then when these group got together, they changed the scoring, so it took away.
And
the one in Washington
is yeah.
in the city for the most part.
That's, I have a real problem with the idea that the scoring was done and then they decided to ignore it and do something else.
And I mean, at times, and we've done this at the NPO, we have the scoring and we also negotiate a little bit, but it's always done in public. It's not a backroom deal to hose two counties. And I mean, we did this recently, rearranging projects, and if we put a little more money into this, we could get all these done. And we did that at the NPO level in public. And I said at the meeting, my objective is to make everybody here mad, but everybody get a little bit moving forward. This was just throw out the top two scoring and let's go down on the list.
They're funding something that scored a 17 when ours scored a 48.
Wow.
I mean, that's a poor, I think the other point that should be made because that's a poor use of public funding. I mean, we can take public funding and pour it down a rat hole, or we can use it in a way that gets bang for the buck. They're voting on a rat hole.
Well, they have a scoring system, and then they just throw it out. It's ridiculous.
Okay, so is the little paragraph I said, I didn't write that down. I think I can recreate it. But play hardball, it's okay to say all those things.
Yes.
It's okay to say that we will explore options with Linn County. And by the way, a lot of this money comes based on population.
I'd like Brad's paragraph here, Brad Borman. And he says, I don't think it will be beneficial for Jones County to assist with trying to overhead TAP Trail Committee's recommendations, et cetera, et cetera. Short term, it may seem beneficial, but in the long term, there may be repercussions due to this, you know, and then he goes on. You are exactly correct, Brad. There are repercussions.
But then they end up voting to take the money away from Linn.
Yes, and he said, you know, he warned against it, and then he voted for it, even though he had warned against it, at least if I'm reading this correctly.
Well, and Linn County didn't have any alternates assigned to it.
I think they've corrected that now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just, again, it gets confusing, but I think, I'm not sure if the person that sent those emails, I think, was on the Trails Committee.
Yes.
So he may not be a voting member?
He may not be a voting member.
Because he's Jones County Conservation Executive Director, so he may not have voted at this task?
He may not have been on the Policy Committee. Okay. I think he was on the Trails Committee. Doug Herman, I think, is the mayor, or City Administrator Monticello, which is in Jones County, I think. So.
And this vote was Policy Committee or TAP Committee?
TAP Committee, Policy Committee.
Policy.
TAP, it's TAP Funding.
TAP Funding Committee recommended to
which is
the policy.
Trails, which is called the Region Trails Advisory Committee. So that's the RTAC. They were doing TAP funding.
Yes.
And they made a recommendation according to the scoring. We would have gotten, the recommendation was about $1 million based on the scoring. And then it's the policy committee that made the change. And as they indicated when they were here, there still has to be a public hearing and a final vote.
And that's by the BCI College Board of Directors.
Okay.
So it's really not too late for them to change?
No.
Seems confusing. If I have this right, Regional Trails voted based on this, that what we call Technical Advisory Committee down here, up there, that's what we call it down here, they voted to throw this out and spread the money all around. Okay? That's the policy board then accepted that and said go to public hearing, right?
No.
They haven't accepted that.
Okay, the Trails Advisory Committee met April 8th, and so I'll print off that packet that I sent you, but that included the minutes from the Trails Committee. They did the scoring according to the scoring principles and the priorities, which are also in that packet, out of the Regional Trails Plan. So that would have been Johnson, Jones, and Linn County would have been funded according to the scoring criteria approved in the plan. So then it went to the policy committee. Before the policy committee, I think these other conversations happened, and it's the policy committee who threw out the trails committee recommendations and the scoring, and went with what was worked out there.
But I thought it was TAP that threw it out.
As I understand it, TAP is the funding.
No, because Tom Braze is on. Tom and Pat are on the TAP. They are not on the policy board, right?
No, the policy committee is not the ECOG board of directors.
Okay. Does it go to the ECOG board of directors, or it goes to the policy?
It went to policy, and then the policy board refers it on to the board of directors, which is happening.
But according to what Doug and Mary said, there still has to be a public hearing.
Yeah, so
that's probably what one of the groups tomorrow will do, is set the public hearing for to did she say, did they say early, was it in June or July? Anyway, probably about a month or so before the board of directors would vote on it.
Okay.
Does anybody need anything else in terms of ammunition going forward for this meeting? All right. I would say we probably, Andy, want to just go ahead and have this on again next Wednesday to discuss sort of the results of the conversation, what was said, et cetera, and how we want to move forward, if there's anything to move forward on.
Okay.
Sound good to everybody?
Yes.
All right. Next up, we have internal processes. Andy, what do you have for us?
You know, I don't have much. I just was going to touch on, you got an email about a parking request. And this is actually the third request, this is the first one related to the new apartments, but it's actually the third one I've gotten in, I would say, the last 6 weeks or so.
From the same building?
No. One was the volunteers at the radio station.
Right.
Another one, and this was just investigating, so it wasn't really a request, but was actually the radio station. And so I think next week I'm going to have it on, or sometime at a work session to maybe kind of set to have a resolution, have the board pass a resolution or something to kind of set. In general, they've been denied. It might get...
Well,
I'd just like to somehow formalize that policy, because especially if every year we're going to have 120 new residents across the street wondering about it.
Well, you've got a
parking resolution. You've got the employee system.
Haven't we already answered the question? We're not in the rental business for parking. Just say no.
We
answer the question. We answer it every year.
I think the other piece here is saying to the city of Iowa City, look, this is a problem.
Right.
There's not enough parking with this building, and you're causing a problem for us, and, you know, we're going to have to deal with this on an ongoing basis. It's essentially almost a daily cost that you're putting on us here,
right.
And so... Right. What can you do to help us make it better?
Yep. So anyway, we'll have it on a future work session. Just
am I wrong? Didn't they get a bonus density for saving Tate Arms? And part of that was they were allowed to build bigger.
Yeah, I believe so.
And they didn't provide any more parking or something.
They didn't have to have much parking.
Yeah. It's like, okay, you saved a building, but you're building this building without parking in your...
We can't... quote, talk about it, but
yes.
In the interim, please send that request to Iowa City.
Yep.
And then also, I'm not going to be in the parking business, and I'm a no, and I don't need to talk about it every single week.
Right.
I don't need to talk about it again. And if you park in our lot, you will be towed. We've already talked about this two or three times since I've been a supervisor. I don't feel the need to talk about it again.
Then I think that's all I have except that, because of, I'm not sure if the sound upgrades are done in the boardroom or not, but, because I wasn't sure whether or not what the temperature would be tomorrow's meeting is over here.
All right. But we cannot get Wi-Fi. So IT has to be here.
Okay.
I can't have a meeting if I can't access anything. And so... I mean, their solution is not working, and I haven't been able to be on it all day long. And
okay.
So I'd rather sit in the hallway over there than be here with my little blue cord.
Okay. We will get that packet. We'll have a PDF packet for you anyway to at least download before the meeting. I'll talk to Angie about that.
Any other internal things from you, Andy?
Nope.
Any internal things from other board members?
Yes. CIT, crisis intervention. Crimey. happened was the date. Set a new date for the bigger group meeting, which means we have to cancel our work session on August 24th in the morning. So same pattern as today, if that's okay with everyone. The CIT meeting would be in the morning, and the work session would need to be at 1:30 in the afternoon, August 24th.
Be a problem.
All right, are we okay with that?
Okay.
So what time would be
August again?
CIT.
It's the CIT group that Rod and I have been assigned to.
Okay.
So unless something changes, so the work session, you wouldn't need to be here in the morning. The work session would be at 1:30.
August 2-4.
August 2-4.
All right, anything else from anybody? All right, seeing nothing.
So my computer died after 2 hours. That's not long enough.
No.
You know, so I am going to talk to Clint and see.
So your battery's messed up, but Pat and I can't get internet.
Can't get Wi-Fi. Yeah, I was able to get Wi-Fi, but I wasn't really doing things other than looking at, you know, I wasn't.
Mine's working fine.
Yeah.
I didn't
and
have
any problems.
On the internal or external?
How much battery
can you see your email?
I've got about my battery left.
Yeah. So mine died after 2 hours.
Andy's going to have to go to IT school or something.
Oh, gosh. Already scary the amount of IT I'm doing.